There are two areas in life that one can pursue. One is the study of Torah, pure and simple, and the other is academic, where one studies and gets a PhD in a particular discipline or field. In the last 30, 40 years, what has exploded into the American scene is the merging of these two disciplines, which is the academic study of Judaism. Truth to tell, this began almost 100 years ago in Germany with the Wissenschaft, where people tried to apply different academic standards and methodologies in order to study Torah, Jewish history, philosophy, Talmud, Midrash. I found some of my greatest moments of joy and happiness when I was able to merge both these two disciplines in getting a PhD and, of course, in the study of Torah as well. Thank you. I like that as inspiration. Not my eyes are my problem. That's my problem. My eyes are falling. Okay. Not the eyes. So it's really a great pleasure to introduce somebody like Professor Shweta, who has merged both these fields, which is the academic study of Talmud, Talmudic literature, which means in effect that one has to apply modern scientific methodologies in the study of Talmud. You're taking a 2,000-year-old literature and you're studying it through the framework, through the prism of the most rigorous analytical scientific fashion. So Shweta is a very well-known international personality. He's one, the Rav Hashem mentioned to me, who began the Shul Shavuot project for Bar Ilan. And there is no rabbi that has not used the Shul Shavuot project Bar Ilan, give you access to hundreds of thousands of Shul Shavuot. And it's actually, of course, irresponsible if a rabbi has to deal with the question and has not surveyed the literature. Prior to this Shul Shavuot project Bar Ilan, it's almost impossible to survey the entire literature of 300,000 Shavuot. Now one can do a word search and one can find all those Shavuot, which broadens your horizons of solving various halakhic issues. It certainly is a pleasure to welcome the professor into our Bet Knesset, and I understand it's going to be a very stimulating presentation. Professor.
Thank you so much. Hachamim told us in the Baraita, "Potchim b'shvach achtanya." You have to begin always by praising your host. So I'd like to thank Rabbi Labaton and Congregation Magen David for hosting this conference. I'd like to thank Rabbi Shama for taking care of all the arrangements. Eli Harari, somewhere here, Eli Harari, Raymond Arkin in Brooklyn, Ezra Denin here. All of them worked very hard to arrange for this overhead projector and whatever is needed. So thank you very much all. I would like just to make a correction to what Rabbi Labaton said. I'm a computer scientist. Mm-hmm. And the Talmud is my hobby and my duty. So I study Talmud, but my profession is computer scientist. Okay, the purpose of this talk is to give a new interpretation of a very famous sugya to both Tubot Daf Tzadi Gimel Amud Aleph, the three women Tubah Shalosh Nashim. This is a very, very puzzling Mishnah, as you shall see, which in some sense has not been solved for 2,000 years. And now there is a very brilliant novel interpretation of it, which is not mine, that's why I can say it's brilliant. And I will tell you in a few minutes who is the author of this interpretation. And this sugya also has some ramifications to bankruptcy issues, to modern bankruptcy issues. So any lawyer here or any businessman that is looking on these issues can find some interesting ideas in what I'm going just now to say. May I suggest that people sitting here should sit that in front of the transparency, because otherwise... Okay. So first, let's see the Gemara, the sugya. We are not going to read the sugya, but I'd like to point out to the Mishnah. Here is the Mishnah that we are going to study. And look at the Gemara of this Mishnah. It's quite short. I would even say it's very short, the sugya, up to this footstop here. That's the whole sugya. There is nothing more on the Mishnah besides what's written here. Also, I should mention that there is no reference to this sugya, either to the Mishnah or to the Gemara, from any other Masechet in Talmud Bavli or Yerushalayim. So whatever we have to do to understand the sugya, we have to do it from this text, because no other reference to this masechet is given, to this sugya is given in any other masechet in Talmud Bavli or Yerushalayim. So look at the sugya. read the Mishnah, which I'm going in a few minutes to explain, and read the short Gemara, Kushia, and some Tirutim, and then at the end, certain Baraita, Tanya, which I'm going to explain.
So what the Mishnah is about? The Mishnah talks
about the case in which Mishaya Nasul Shalosh Nashim, someone was married to three women, Umek, and died. Three women, right? Okay. So, I'm just quoting the Mishnah, not the Mishnah. That says, Mishaya Nasu Shalosh Shanim, Umek. Okay. So now, the three women, since she died, the three women are entitled to get the Ketubah. So suppose Sarah had the Ketubah of 100 zuz, $100, say, with a Ketubah of $200. And Rachel has it about $300.
Now,
and there is a bond, the estate that was left by this husband was maybe $100 only. So there is not enough in the bond, in the inheritance, to. So there is not enough in the Rizabon, in the inheritance of this guy, the estate, to give all the Ketubot. The all the Ketubot are $100 and $200, $600. And they said what he left was only $100. That's one case. In another case he left maybe $200. In a third case maybe he left $300. So how are we going to distribute the estate between the three women, which is not enough to satisfy each one of the claims of this couple? That's the Mishnah. This is what the Mishnah is talking about. Now we have first to understand that the Ketubah is like any debt. It's a Baal Chob. It's like a Baal Chob. So usually when you have different creditors, different Baal Chob, and the guy doesn't have enough to pay for everybody, there are priorities. First priority is according to date. When was the loan given? So the first creditor gets first priority, he gets whatever he can. What is left is the second creditor, and what is left is the third, etc. And for the woman, it should be the same. So the first woman, the first two bars should get priority, and then the second one, third. So we are talking here, probably, that's what Rashi said, about the case in which the three women were given two bars the same day. So there are no priorities, they all have the same priority, because the two bars were given on the same day. And since the hour is not written in the Ketubah, so we don't know which one is first, which one is second. In any case, the Gemara says you don't take care of hours, the day is the most important thing. So we are assuming that all of these three women had same Ketubah the same day. And so we are now asking how to divide the $100 in this case between the three women. So the Mishnah says the following. If there is a bond worth $100, then we divide it equally between the three women, 33 and 3 dollars for Sarah, for Rivka, and for Rachel. Next sense, I mean, we are dividing it equally because there is not enough for every woman. And so we have here what's called Halukah Shava. We are dividing the estate equally between all the women. Okay. In the second case, in which the estate was $200, the Mishnah says we give the first one, Sarah, 50, so half her claim. We give Rivka 75. We give Rachel 75. It's very strange. That's why you have question marks here. Why? What are these numbers? Why Sarah gets half of 50, and why Rivka and Rachel get exactly the same amount, 75, although Rivka's claim is 200 and Rachel's claim is 300? So you don't really understand. By the way, even the first case, according to the to what is happening now in the United States, Israel, all over the world, when you have such a case, well, then you divide it proportionally to the claim. So if Sarah is claiming 100 out of the 600 claims, so she'll get 1/6 of the estate. And the Rivka is asking for 200 out of the 600, 1/3, so she gets 1/3. And Rachel is asking for 300 out of the 600, so it's 50%. She should get 50% of the. But this is not what the first case, what the Mishnah said about the first case. Okay. The third case of the 300, indeed we see that the Mishnah says Sarah should get 50, Rivka 100, and Rachel 150. This is exactly proportionally to the claim. Sarah is claiming 1/6
of all of the claims, so it's getting one-sixth of the 300, that's 60. The tsar is asking for a third of all of the claims, so it's getting a third of the estate. And the rachel is asking for 300, that's half of all the claims, so she's getting half of the estate. So it seems that in this case, the Mishnah says that we should distribute the estate
yachasit lamaor, proportionally to the claim.
Okay. But this Mishnah, as you can see, is very easy to understand, but it's not very easy to understand the principle according to which the Mishnah is setting this number. First of all, we have this second case that we cannot make any sense of it. Why are these numbers given for this case? Also, we can see different principles for different cases. In this case, the Halukah Shabbat, self distribution equally, and in this case, the Hasid Lamot, proportionally. So, you should tell us what is your principle. More than that, suppose you have not three women or three creditors, but four creditors, six creditors, 17 creditors. And suppose the numbers are different. What is the principle according to which the Mishnah intends to teach us how to distribute? We don't see the principle. So this is a very puzzling Mishnah.
Now follow this, the Gemara should clarify. So let's see what the Gemara says about this. The Gemara begins Ma'alach HaSugya. We are now going through the sugya. The Gemara begins by asking a kushya, a difficulty. And the kushya of the Gemara is that the numbers don't fit. The Gemara says in the second case, we saw that Sarah gets 50, she should get only 33 and 30. That's the kushya of the Gemara. Why? Why does the Gemara think that in the second case, the first one should get 33 and 30? Probably the Gemara knew what is the principle of the Mishnah. Knew. And she's asking, according to that principle, then the numbers don't fit for the second thing. How did the Gemara understand the Mishnah? We don't know. The Gemara doesn't say. She just asked a kushya. But the mere fact that it's asking a kushya, probably the Gemara understood or knew or supposed to know what is the principle of the Mishnah. And that's why she's making kushya that the numbers don't fit this principle. Okay. So, Keter Devina has Gemara, if it's that a Mishnah, we don't know because the Gemara doesn't say. But we have Rashi, and we have Rif, and Rashi and Rif gave a certain explanation on how the Gemara understood the Mishnah. And this is the Shita, the system of Shebudit, of liens. You know, whenever someone has a loan, there is a mortgage, or a lien on the land. So there is a Shita called Shita Shebudim. I'm going to explain it later, this is not important for us now. And Rashi and Rif say that this is the way the Gemara understood the Mishnah, and that's why the Gemara makes the Kushya on the Mishnah. Okay. So what is the tirut? Okay, so we have very strange tirut here. First tirut of Shmuel, he said, well, it's true that the numbers don't fit. Why? Because in this case, the Mishnah is talking about the case in which Hayu Eskenim Pnimiyim Ben Anashim. There were a priori agreements between the women, according to which, let's say, the second woman told the first one, look, I'm not going to argue with you about the first $100, let's argue, etc. So there were prior agreements, and if you look at this agreement, as Shmuel explains them, then you will see that the number in the second case fit. That's very strange, because the Gemara doesn't, the Mishnah doesn't say about any a priori agreement at all. So that's very strange. And the Gemara said, if this was a priori agreement, then the third case doesn't fit. So Shmuel says, true, but the third case there was a different a priori agreement. Well, that's of course, Tirut very dahuk. It can be that the Mishnah, which is trying to tell us the principle, to teach us how to distribute the estate, is talking about a case in which there were a priori agreements, different a priori agreements between Zuma. So, what is the usual case in which there are no a priori agreements? Teach us about that first. So, it's clear that the Tirut is very dahuk and does not represent the chapter of the Mishnah.
Is that pointed out by any of the
Rishonim? That the Tirut is dahuk, yeah. Well, yes, but what can you do about it? This is what Shmuel said. I mean, you don't need Rishonim to see that the Tirut is very dahuk. Well, he said that, no, there were no a priori agreements between the women. But, ha'izavon hikiyah b'shtet tisot, b'schumim shonim, u'b'tzora shona, b'shnei mikim achonim. Means that some of the women, before coming to Beit-Din, they went to the estate, they seized some of the estate for themselves, and so they are coming to Beit-Din after they already took something from the estate. So, Tom, and what part did they take? So, Rabbeinu explained in the second case they took this part, this part took this part, that part took this part, and when you look at the numbers, now they fit. Okay, this is very strange, because the Mishnah doesn't talk about this case at all. Supposedly the Mishnah is talking about the usual case in which two women are coming to the gym, they have to bat and they have to pay them. That's it. Finish with the Sugya. Two Tirutim, both of them are very, very dachuk, and you are still left with your question, what is the principle of the Mishnah? What the Mishnah had in mind when it gives us the three different cases, and what should we do in our different number of creditors, in different amounts, etc. And then there is one more line in the Sugya. Very interesting. And this is the line. Tanya. Zor Mishnah to Binatan. The Baraita says, this is the opinion of Binatan. The Mishnah that we just read, which was Tam Mishnah. So usually the halakha should be like Tam Mishnah. No machlokes, nothing, Tam Mishnah halakha. But the Baraita says, this is the opinion of Binatan. The Biomer, En Ani Roeh Dibri Natan, Dibri Natan Be'el. I don't really see, I don't agree, with the opinion of the Gelatan in this case. Ella Cholkot Beshabe. They should distribute the state equally between all the world. That's all. This is very strange because of several reasons. First of all, the Bi Omer, En Ani Roeh Dibri Natan Be'el, Ella Cholkot Beshabe. So, who edited the Mishnah? Who wrote the Mishnah? Rabbi. So, why didn't you put it in the Mishnah? That's it. Why do we leave the Mishnah as Tam Mishnah? And in the Baraita, Rabbi said, well, I don't agree, and I think they should do it other way. Why don't you put it in the Mishnah? You edit the Mishnah. Also, the language, En Ani Roeh Dibri Natan Be'el, is very strange. There is only one other place in the Talmud, one other place in which Rabbi says, En Ani Roeh Dibri Rabbi Shimon Be'el. That's it. So the language is very rare and unique. So maybe you can interpret it as saying, if you Omer, I don't really understand the Rabbi Natan. I don't see the logic of Rabbi Natan was one generation before Rabbi. So Rabbi may be saying here, I don't really understand the logic of Rabbi Natan. If I can't understand it, so I have another opinion, and this is Cholkot Beshabe. What does it mean Cholkot Beshabe? It can't be taken literally as we should distribute it equally. Because if this is the case, then if the stake is 450, each one gets 150, so the first woman gets more than her claim. That's of course impossible. So we have to interpret Rabbi's Rabbi opinion. Now, first of all, you see that Rabbi is Halek or Rabbi Natan. Whenever Rabbi Halek on any Tana, Al-Hakir Rabbi. Al-Hakir Rabbi Mechavero, of course, and not the Havera. So if Halek on Rabbi, Al-Hakir Rabbi. But if he's Halek on any Tana whatsoever, Al-Hakir Rabbi. So in this case, halakha is como Rabbi. We can't say anything because Rabbi says halakot b'shabe. So this is the halakha, halakot b'shabe. But what is halakot b'shabe? There are different opinions, two opinions. How do we interpret Rabbi opinion halakot b'shabe? Yes, mahalok is posteli for Jibri Rabbi, and we shall see it in a moment. What is the different pirushim of Rabbi opinion? Okay. So the Mishnah is not halakha. The Mishnah is not halakha because Rabbi halak and said different way. Since the Mishnah is not the halakha, we can say what we can. What do we care? What halakha? Whatever Mishnah says, it says, and that's it.
Well, this is not so. We'll see why. First of all, if you look at Harif on the Sugya, Harif, as you all know, of course, is the most important posek after the Gaonim. And he is the one that made a summary of the old Talmud, very short summary, with the halakhot. All of the halachot of the Talmud, leaking all the machlokot, all the akadot, just the halachot. And Harif was father of Rambam. Father of Rambam Maimonides was a student of Rimi Gash, and Rimi Gash was a student of Harif. And that's why Rambam said in the Hakdamah of Mishneh Torah that in all the 40,000 halachot that he had in Mishneh Torah, he differs from Harif only in 10, maybe in 10 at the maximum, because he always followed Harif. So Harif is the most important posek of Islam. And usually it's very, very short, very concise, because it's just halakha. Now for this sugya, open Harif for this sugya, and you will see four pages, not four lines, four pages on this sugya. Very strange for Harif, never, usually it's one line, two lines, halakha, this halakha, that's it, four pages. Moreover, I will read to you the beginning of what he says on this sugya. Amat nita u'gmarad ila,
Shatlu v'taru v'kamel v'chanel v'racha. On this Mishnah, on this Gemara, it was studied a lot, discussed a lot by the ancient ones, by the rabbis of the ancient period. V'la salta lehu kol ekor. They didn't understand it, they didn't interpret it well at all. The Keren de la salta lehu kahoge, since they couldn't really explain it in a logical way as it should be, had any shikul adda'at, upas ka alakha, upal geren lehu ma'ona. So since they couldn't really understand the Mishnah and the Sugya, they reported back to their own opinion, and they said it should be distributed in Fuma Mona, meaning in a proportional to the plane, which is now what's happening all over the world. But this is not the Mishnah and the Gemara, this is their own opinion, because they couldn't understand the Mishnah and the Gemara. Vela talka alibad the Gemara, korita, velo gematichin. This halakha of theirs, that you have to distribute it proportionally to the plane, is not according to the Gemara, and is not according to the Mishnah. That's their opinion, because they didn't understand the Mishnah and the Gemara. The Anan, but we, Anan, but we looked into it very deeply. With the help of God, we discovered really the good time, the good reason, the good logic of this Sugya. And we explained the Matnitin, the Mishnah and the Gemara, according to the Divrei Rabotenu, the Pirush Ba'aliyah, a very excellent Pirush, Umidin Nehirin, very clear Inyanim, there is one Sukkah, so there is no doubt that this is the Pirush of the Sugya. So first of all, you see from Marif that this was the day passing Mishnah Sugya. He said that nobody, till him, nobody really explained it. But he has a very good explanation of the Sugya, and he goes on for 4 pages to explain what is the Sugya. More than that, he does something which he never did in any other place of the Talmud. He tells the reader, look, maybe you don't understand Aramaic, which I am, the Arif is in Aramaic, so I'm going to write for you in Arabic, a full explanation of the Sugya, and this is an appendix to my Pirush. And if you look in Arif on this Sugya, you will see on the bottom of the page, an Arabic Pirush of the Sugya, translated to Hebrew, of course, 2 different translations, so you can see it only in Hebrew, but probably you can see it in Arabic in some old documents or something. So again, these 4 pages in Arabic that he wrote earlier in Arabic to explain the Sugya. Read this only one more time, the whole Talmud. So something is really very complex about this Sugya that made Arif not only explain it in 4 pages, but also adding an expression in Arabic in the case you don't follow his argument in Arabic. So it's clear that this is a very puzzling Sugya. However, his explanation doesn't help us much. Why? Because he tries to explain the way the Gemara understood the Mishnah. And he explained it by the system of Shebudim, of Lir. Very good expression. But the way the Gemara understood the Mishnah is not the correct way of the Mishnah. Because we saw that there are many Kushiyot of the Mishnah, and the Tirutim that the Gemara gives are very Dachukim. So even if you know what the Gemara understood from the Mishnah, it doesn't help us to understand the Mishnah, because this type of understanding is very dahuk, and there are a lot of kushot. So even when we will see what the Rif says about the Sugya, and we see it, it doesn't help us to understand the pshat of the Mishnah, because if this is the way the Gemara understood it, then there are kushot, and the kushot didn't find any good to repeat. So probably this is not the way to understand the Mishnah. Okay, so, but this is the Rif, and Rashi follows Rif, of course, in this case, and they also interpret the Sugya according to Shittat HaShabud. And this is what you will find in all the Farshim, including in Art Kol or whatever it is. They just quote Rashi and the Pirush of the Sugya according to Shittat HaShabud, which can maybe explain the Gemara, but does not explain the Mishnah, because the Gemara, the way she understood the Mishnah, is not clear, is not good. If you look at the Tzafot on the same page, you will see 3 or 4 Diburim, again quite strange. In one of them, Tzafot says, Lo yadati amai, I don't know why this and this was said in the Gemara. In another Dibur, La yitzarish ta'amad ha'ay nita. Really, the reason or the logic of this thing was not really well explained in the Gemara. In a third Dibur, Lo yadati repi ma'at ma'ashara matnitin. My rabbi didn't understand what the Mishnah is talking about. So, in some sense, Tzafot, Merimilia dies, they are desperate, they say, we don't know what's happening here, I don't understand, I don't know. Again, something very strange, usually Tzafot can find Tzafotim for everything. In this case, Tzafot says, something is going here which we don't understand. So, apparently, the Sugya is very complex. Now, as I said, what do we care about the Mishnah? It's not halacha. What do we care? Why do we have to understand it? Maybe that's why many Mitarshim did at all try to extend the Mishnah, because this is not the halacha. Halacha is like Rabbi. So what do we care?
But remember, my friends, that Zo Mishnah to Dinatan. The Mishnah is the opinion of Dinatan. And the Gemara says in many places. Let's see, for example, in Baba Kama.
Amar Rabba, Ribinatan Dayanahu. Ribinatan is a very expert judge in the name of Monor, in anything that has to do with monetary problems. Venahit Laumtadi Dina. Usually he goes deep, very deep in the situation. So, Ribinatan is well known, was well known, by being a very good Dayan who can deeply go into Sugya, especially if it is monetary problem. And then again, Masech Baban Tan, another Masech, Amar Rabba, who was the master of Rabba, Nekod the Ribinatan Gadar, always follow the opinion of Ribinatan. The Dayanahu, Venahit Laumtadi Dina, because he is very good in Gidema Monot, he goes deep into the mat. So how can you just dismiss the Mishnah and say we don't care? This is Rabbi Natan. He can't say that's empty words. Probably there is a principle behind what he said. What is this principle? What to understand? And this is what you are going to see. A new explanation of the Mishnah of Rabbi Natan, which really gives fantastic new life on the idea of Rabbi Natan. As you can see, that Rabbi Natan was a very, very deep thinker and very deep judge that can go into, as the Gemara says, into really the deep part of the text. Okay, so we are now going to see another interpretation which was inspired by game theory. Game theory is a branch of mathematics which deals with economical problems, the theory of economics, theory of games. It was invented in the 50s by a brilliant Jewish mathematician, von Neumann, which was described as the most brilliant brain on earth. Not only among mathematicians. Von Neumann, very well known, he was one of the inventors of the computers. He was brilliant. He invented theory of games, which is used to analyze war games and market games, etc. So, this interpretation was inspired by the principle of the theory of games. And it was given by Professor Robert Israel Oman from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, from the Department of Mathematics, with some collaboration of Professor Michael Mashler. Now, Professor Oman, both Professor Oman and Mashler were my teachers when I studied mathematics at the Hebrew University in the early 60s in Jerusalem. So I know Professor Oman very well. He's a brilliant mathematician, and he's also a brilliant Talmid Chacham. Big Talmid Chacham at the same time. He mixed Talmid Chacham with being a brilliant mathematician. In fact, he was many times candidate for Nobel Prize in Economics. Many times. And the last time he was candidate was also the time, a few years ago, when Nash, Professor Nash, was also candidate. Who is Nash? Anyone who read the book Beautiful Mind? Or saw the movie Beautiful Mind? This was Professor Nash. He was a half-mad mathematician, brilliant, gaon, genius, but also he had problems. He was schizophrenic, and many times he was in and out of mental hospitals. And when he was out of the hospital, he did mathematics, brilliant mathematics, very, very complex, mostly in the theory of games. So he contributed a lot to the theory of games. So he was candidate for the Nobel Prize at the same year that also Professor Roman was candidate. Now, if anyone has the book, The Beautiful Mind, look at the appendix of the book, you will see a whole story of this candidature of Nash and Robert Oman on Nobel Prize for economics. And finally, Nash got it because of political maneuvering, also because he was a very miserable man. I mean, he was in and out of a mad hospital, etc. So he got it. Just to tell you that Professor Oman is really a very well-known internationally figure. And you can just look at Google and write Robert Oman, and you will see many, many thousands of citations of his work and his candidature. So it's really brilliant. Now, Mashler was also from Hebrew University. He contributed something to the Pitaron, to the solution. And I know them both, and they are very different. Robert Oman is actually the victim in Hacham. Michael Mashler is a complete Amharic, never probably opened the Sugya in his life, and he doesn't know anything about it. But he contributed to some of the mathematics of the solution. And then there is a contribution, very interesting contribution that we shall see,
by a certain mathematician, Dr. Marek Kaminski, Polish mathematician from Warsaw University. I suspect he is a Jew, I'm not really sure. He was in Poland, and then he kept New York University for a few years. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but this is Marek Kaminski, and I'll show you what he contributed. Very interesting thing. So this is then the solution proposed by Professor Omer.
Just as a personal touch, since many people here are family or acquaintances, I saw in my archives this beautiful picture from 1960, so 45 years ago, when I was a student, third-year student in mathematics at the University of Jerusalem. This is Professor Oman. This was his first year at the University, just coming from the United States, very fresh, very enthusiastic. And his area was theory of games. And I am here, you're Abdeshaman Ehman, your obedient servant with a black kippah, very attentively listening to the lecture. And you can see the blackboard full of formula and notation, etc. And by the way, sitting beside me was my best friend these days, Asa Kasher, who is the grandson of Rabbi Menachem Kasher of Torah Shlema. You probably know Rabbi Menachem Kasher, who wrote 40 volumes of Torah Shlema, many other books. So this was the grandson. He is now a professor of philosophy and ethics, a very renowned professor. So we are good friends, and this is myself, and this is Robert Oman. Just to tell you that I'm talking about his people. I mean, Robert Oman was here, and he was... So, by the way, that's a very tragic note to this thing, that Robert Oman had a...
Of course, he had a few children, but one of them was a very brilliant and Hacham, very young man, who studied in Yeshivot Yerushalayim. And he was killed in the Yom Kippur War. The Yom Kippur War, he was killed, and Professor Oman took it very, very hard, of course. And since then, he grew a beard, and now he has a very white beard like that, and he has very long. And in fact, he said in one of the papers that he published that this Sugya was pointed to him by his son, who told him maybe you can do something about this Mishnah, following the ideas of story of games. So Oman worked on that for many years, and finally he came up with the solution. So when he published the paper about it, he dedicated to the memory of his son. So maybe you should also dedicate this show to the memory of this very brilliant Tamid Hacham, who died very young, at age 21, killed in Yom Kippur. Oman, as I said, published this paper about 15 years ago. He published it in one of the most important and prestigious journals of economic theory. And immediately after he published the paper, of course he published it citing the Mishnah and the Talmud and explaining what is the Mishnah and what is the Talmud, because he was writing to an international audience. And how we came to the idea that this is the principle of the Mishnah, and he suggested maybe it should be adopted as a principle for dealing with Bakhtovsky problems, etc., and proving also the theorems that you are going to see here. And finally, of course, he published it, and it made a lot of waves in the community of economists and game theorists, and a lot of papers were written following that paper, discussing it and enlarging the idea, etc. So this was something that brought the Mishnah and the Talmud to the attention of all the international mathematicians and the people in game theory, that for the first time they were discussing together the Mishnah and the Talmud and what the Mishnah said about.
Okay, so now for the interpretation. Let's for a moment forget about the Mishnah completely. And let us look at another sugya, which everybody here probably learned it and studied it when he was in high school. Mishnah, the first Mishnah of Masech Baba Metzia, Sinai Mohadim, very well known Mishnah. As I'm saying, everybody, every young boy of age of 14 or 15, probably saw it. What does the Mishnah say? Sinai Mohadim Betali. Two people are coming to the Bedjin, holding together a garment, any kind of tali, a garment. This one says it's mine, all of it is mine. Another one says all of it is mine. I found it, this one says I found it, it's mine. And there are no witnesses, no proof whatsoever. There are no and there will be no witnesses. And each one of them claims the whole garment for him. So what do we do? This one says, we split the garment between them, or the value of the garment between these two people. We give half of it to the first one, half of it to the second one. Because we don't have proof, we don't have witnesses, we don't know to whom this garment belongs, so we split it between the two. Okay. But in the case, the Omer Kula Sheli, the first one, let's say Reuven said, it's mine, all of it is mine. The Omer and Shimon says, Hitya Sheli.
half of it is mine. Half of it. I believe that half of it is yours, but half of it is mine. And the first son of man says, no, all of it is mine. So how do we split it now between the two? So the Mishnah says, Zeratet Shosha Halakim, the one that claims the whole garment takes 3/4 of it, and the one that claiming half gets 1/4 of it. Of course, in value. Why is it so? This is very easy to understand, and Rashi explains it very, very clearly, and we are going now to put it in the following way. We have the Reuven and Shimon. In the first case, Reuven is claiming the whole garment, 100% of it, and Shimon is claiming the whole garment, 100% of it. So they don't agree on anything. Agreement is zero, because everyone wants the whole garment for himself. And the contested part of the garment is the whole garment, 100% of it. So what is the decision of the Mishnah? We take the contested part and we split it in half. Half to Reuven and half to Shimon. Good. Let's take the second part of the Mishnah. Reuven is claiming the whole garment, 100%. Shimon is only claiming half of it. So in fact, all parties agree that half of it belongs to Shimon and belongs to Reuven, because Shimon agrees that only half is mine, so half is yours. And Reuven also says, all of it is mine, so half certainly is mine. So they agree on half, and they disagree on one half. So the decision of the Mishnah is the following. If you agree on one half that it belongs to Reuven, you have to give it to Reuven, because all of you agree that it's for Reuven, so we give it to Reuven. Okay. The contested part then is one half. We divide it equally between you, because there is Reuven, there is Shimon, each one is claiming this half for himself, we don't know who it is, so we split it half and half. So finally then, Reuven gets one half, which was agreed by everybody, and 1/4, so he gets 3/4, and Shimon gets one zero agreed, and 1/4, so he gets 1/4. That's what the Mishnah says here. Then it takes Shosha Halakim, 3/4. Why? Because half was agreed upon by everybody that belongs to Reuven, so Reuven takes it, and half of the contested part, that's 1/4, so 3/4 for Reuven, 1/4 for Shimon. So, this is the Mishnah, as I said, everybody knows it more or less, and the interpretation. So we can put this principle of the Mishnah in the following way. We call it Shita Shnai Mohadim. This is the system of Shnai Mohadim. In English, we may call it the contested garment principle. Contested garment, so CG. So, what is this principle? Mamona Mustam, Ebana, if some part of the money is agreed upon by all the parties that it should belong to it, we give it to it, because there is no discussion about it. But when I'm mutar mesafek, part of the claims that are mesafek, this one is asking for it, and this one is asking for it, and we don't know who it belongs, okay. And in English, whatever is agreed as belonging to it, is given to it, because there is no dispute about that. And what is contested, whatever is contested, is equally divided between all the claims. That's the principle of the Mishnah. I don't think anybody here will dispute this very logical sense.
I would.
Yeah, okay.
My question would be whether or not the rationale of Shimon is correct or not, in that he may have basing his claim that you deserve half of it on a false premise. He may not know the halacha, I may know. And the question over here would be whether he's saying, whether I'm right or wrong conceptually, I'm giving it to you. That is all the answer.
Why? When he's wooden, like
you know, no, because I'm even like that out there.
Why?
Why? Because I think it's probably yours, but even if it's not, you're really happy. Listen, even if he says that maybe it's really half mine, but I want to be Zim Shadim on one hand.
Okay.
The other hand, we might say that Shimon's basing himself on a false halakhic principle that he thinks that if we both hold on to it, it's really, you should get half no matter what. And maybe he doesn't know the halakha, but you ask local. So now he's saying, well, first, implicitly, tell me the halakha, and then I'll decide what's happening on. So the question is whether he's mevater no matter what, or he's basing it on truth.
So you are supposing maybe that these people are coming here not in good faith, and everyone is trying to find out beforehand what's the halakha, so that you put it in the best way and the best
one possible.
Yeah, okay, but this is not what Mishnah says. I mean, that's the interpretation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that this is the case and this is the way to divide it, I mean, I'm just saying it looks logical. You can maybe have machlokes on this. But this is what Mishnah says, and it looks logical. At least it looks logical, although there might be different opinions. But anyway, this is what Mishnah says. So we call this the principle of the contested garment. Okay. Now maybe this is the only place in the Mishnah or the Gemara that we are discussing this. No. We find that this idea, this principle of contested garment and how to deal with it is all over the Talmud. And I'll give you two different places where this is discussed. We have a Tosefta on this Masechet Baba Mishnah. Tosefta gives another numerical example of the same case. The Tosefta says, Ze omer kula sheli, Ze omer shlish sheli. Reuven claims the whole is mine, and Shimon says, one third of it is mine. So this is a different numerical example. So how do we explain it? Exactly the way we did it before. So the Tosefta says, Ze shaba she'en lo ba pachot mechamisha halakim, he will get 5/6 parts, and the one who says, third is mine, will get only a sixth of it. Why? We can do the computation. Let's do the computation. What is Muskar? What is agreed upon? Two-thirds of the garment is agreed upon to belong to Reuven, because Shimon says, I'm your third. I mean, but the two-thirds are yours. And Shimon and Reuven, of course, says, everything is mine. So, two-thirds are mine. So there is no dispute about the two-thirds, so give it to Reuven. The third is one-third. Reuven claims it's his. Shimon also claims it's his. So we divide it equally. One-sixth to Reuven, one-sixth to Shimon. And when we add it together, we find that we have 5/6 to Reuven and 1/6 to Shimon. So the Tosefta is giving a different example, numerical example, to show us that this is the principle. This is how to compute. Here is another example, very, very interesting one, from a totally different context, from Masechet Yevamot. Masechet Yevamot, the Gemara brings the following case, and I'll first read it in Aramaic, and then I will explain it. The Gemara says, Masechet Yevamot, Daf Lamed Chet, Safek ubnei Abam shebaw lahalok nechse Saba. Safek amar, ahu gavra bar mitmahu, upalga didihu. Ubnei Abam amre, ahunad, umantah islach behadam. Palga dekamodelehu, shafle. Tilta dekamodule, shakar. Pach lehudavka, abe yaron amtal safek, vecholik. What is the case? We have a man, Yaakov, and he had two children, Reuven and Shimon. Reuven died without having children. We call Mitna, the one who died. Since he died without children, his brother Shimon has to be a bam of his wife. So okay, he took his wife as a bama. He didn't wait the 3 months to find out what's happening. He just took her, and indeed after 7 months she gave birth to a boy. So she gave birth to Yamin. Now we don't know whether Yamin is the son of Shimon after 7 months of pregnancy, or maybe he's the son of Reuven after 9 months of pregnancy. So Yamin is Safed. We don't know. Is he the son of Reuven or maybe he's the son of Shimon? Okay. Shimon, on the other hand, also has two sons, Yachin and Boaz. Now Reuven and Shimon died, and the Saba Yaakov was still alive. And then Yaakov died. Now when Yaakov died, all of his inheritance now is coming to Yamin, Yachin, and Boaz, and they have to split it between them. How do they have to split it between Yamin, Yachin, and Boaz? So Yamin says, look, I am the son of Reuven, and you both too are the sons of Shimon. Reuven and Shimon get inheritance from Yaakov, 50-50, they are two brothers. So Reuven gets 50%, Shimon gets 50%, but both of them died. So I am the inheritor of Reuven, I am the Yoresh of Reuven, so I get the 50%, and you together are the Yoreshim of Shimon, you get together 50%, equal 25%, or whatever you want to split between you, I don't care. So this is what the Mishnah says, Safek ubnei Abba, this is Safek Yamin, and this are ubnei Abba, Yachin Uboaz, the son of the Abba. Shebaw lahalok b'nechseh Saba, Yaakov. Safek Amar, ahu gavra bar mitnahu, Reuven died, and I have this son, who forgot you, and half of the Yerusha is mine, because after Yerusha is Reuven died, I'm his only son, I get half the Yerusha. Ubnei Abam Amri, but Yachin and Boaz says, no, Ahura, you are our brother, because you are the son of Shimon, right? You are the son of Shimon, you are like us, so Reuven died without any sons, any children, so all of the Yerusha of Yaakov comes to Shimon, And you have three sons of Shimon. So you see,
the third.
But Shimon died. Did they still live in the third? No, the son died. They didn't really speak to Shimon yet. Even after that, Jacob.
Shimon's personal possession.
Yes.
If they say, you
are
a brother, you have to split all that with
him
as well.
Yes, but maybe Shimon didn't have any. Right. As you know, all the money is in the Sabbath. Anyway, so this is the case of Moravim. Now, how do we decide this case? We don't know if Amin is the son of Reuven, and we will never know. Now, there can be no witnesses, no proofs. That's the case. So the Gemara says, we see this exactly according to Shita Shnayim Mohagim. And this is the case. Ta'anat HaSafek, the Safek says, half is for me, half is for the brother. The brother says, no, two-thirds is for us, because there are two brothers, and one-third only is for him. So let us try and do the computation for this case according to Shita Shnayim Mohagim. What is Muskam? HaSafek, it's Muskam that HaSafek should get at least one-third. Even the Ahim agree that you should get one third. So one third is Muskan that belongs to the Safek. One half certainly belongs to the Ahim, because even the Safek says, okay, you are entitled to one half. So this is agreed. So whatever is agreed, we give. So we give one third to the Safek, and we give one half to the Ahim, because everybody agreed. What is left then? One third and one half, that's 2 over 6, and 3 over 6. So we are left with 1/6, this is the Safek. This is what the Gemara says.
Pashlehu Danka. Danka is 1/6.
So we are just 1/6, this is the Safek. So what do we do with the Safek? Okay, divide it equally.
So we give 1/12 to the Safek and 1/12 to the Ahim.
So finally the Safek gets 5/12 and the Ahim gets 7/12. And this is exactly what the Gemara says.
Pashlehu Danka, and then 1/12 Safek,
Machalkin. This Danka is 1/6, this is. So it is that this type of principle Shnayim Mohagim goes on and all the Talmud in many different contexts, many different. So this is principle of the Talmud.
Okay. Now let's go back to our Mishnah. And I am reminding you of the three cases of the Mishnah. First case in which we have a double of 100, second case of 200, third case of 300. And let us begin and try to understand the most difficult case, which is the second case of 200, in which the numbers don't count. Now, let us suppose for 1 minute that the Dayan got a nevuah or a dream, whatever it is, according to which he decides to give Sarah and Rivka together 125. Why? Don't ask me now. We'll talk about it. Somehow he got a nebuah, a ren, a hint or something. He said, okay, I have to give, maybe a malach, then I told him, you have to give 100 together, 125. Okay. But how do I split 125 between Sarah and Rivka? Sarah is asking for 100, Rivka is asking for 200. How do I split 125 between the two of them? Ah, well, we have the principle of Shnayim Mohagim. So let's apply it in this case. So the state is, in this case, 125. This is what is allocated to both of them together. Now, what is Muskan? Sarah is asking only for 100. Rivka is asking for 200. So even Sarah agrees that 25 belongs to Rivka, because the state is 125. I am claiming only 100. So 25 is Muskan to go to Rivka. What about the 100? Well, the 100 left, Sarah is asking for it, and the Rivka is asking. So it's 50. We give 50 to Sarah, 50 to Rivka. So all in all, Sarah gets 50, and Rivka gets 75. This is exactly what Mishnah says. Sarah gets 50, Rivka gets 25. What about, let's say, second case,
what about this case in which we see that Rivka gets 75 and Rachel gets 75? Why?
So we do the same type of computation. Suppose someone gives the Dayan or Ra'ah, you have to give Rivka and Rachel together 150.
Okay, so how does it split 150 between the two, these two kitubot, between Rivka and Rachel?
So, is anything agreed upon? No, because the state is 150, Rivka is asking for 200, so Rivka is asking for the whole state, and Rachel is asking for 300, so of course he's asking for the whole of it. Because there is nothing they agree upon. So if there is nothing they agree upon, they should take 150, because both women are claiming it. So we divide it 75 here and 75 here,
This is exactly what Mishnah says. Iftar gets 75, Rachel gets 75. And you can check again the last pair,
in which
we take Sarah and Rachel. We check for Sarah and Iftar, we check for Iftar and Rachel. Now we check for Sarah and Rachel. Sarah and Rachel. No, we already checked that. That's why I don't see. So the third case can be also discussed, and we can find that the number is. Now let's take the third case. We saw that the Mishnah says it should be split 50-150 because of the proportionality of the claim. But this is not so. Look, for example, at the 100. As the case of Sarah and Rachel. Sarah is asking for 50, Rachel is asking for 150. Not asking, but he's getting 50 and Rachel comes. So together they should get 200. Suppose we know somehow that they should get together 200. How do we split the 200 between them? If you do again the computation, or you still use this computation, you will see that this is exactly what the Mishnah says. And if you check for the two other pairs, you will see exactly the same thing. If you compute the total amount that the pair is getting, and you see how it should be split, you see it is exactly according to this Shittat Shnei Hachashim. Even the first case, 33 and 30, it's not because equal part. It's because of Shittat Shnei Hachashim. Why? Because if we look at this case, 33 and 30, the step is 100. So both Sarah and Rivka, for example, claim the whole amount for themselves. But Sarah is asking for 100, Rivka for 200, and the stake is only
the stake is 100. The first thing.
So we have to, they don't agree on anything because the stake is 100. Sarah wants it all, and Rivka wants it all. So we split it between them. And if we look at the total amount that is given to Sarah and Rivka together, which is 66 and 2/3. Suppose someone talks to Diane, this is the amount they should get. How does it split it between Sarah and Sarah? Equally, because it's the amount of Sarah. So what do we find then? Something very strange. We can check that these numbers, when you look for every pair in every case, we will see that the total amount allocated to this pair is distributed between them according to the national head. So what does that mean? Well, we can now say the following. We can now interpret the Mishnah according to this CG, contested government principle, in the following way. First, let us define the following. A distribution of the estate between the creditors, we call it CG consistent to the principle of Shnei Mahadir, if the amount given to any pair of creditors is consistent with the CG principle, when applied to the total amount allocated to that pair. So suppose someone brings to me a distribution. He said, look, we have 17 creditors, this is the amount of the claim, distribute them according to these 17 numbers. So I have to check every pair of creditors, of this, every pair, to see what is the amount allocated to both of them, and to see whether it is not, or yes, allocated according to Shittat Shnei Hachashim. Because if not, they can come to Beit Din and say, look, Beit Din, you get both of us together, let's say 200, but you didn't split this two, and we are disputing this amount, and we are not splitting it according to Shittat Shnei Hachashim. So we should check for every pair of creditors that the principle of Shnei Hachashim really applies for every pair of creditors. So we call such a distribution, if it exists, we call it a CG consistent. It's consistent with Shittat Shnei Hachashim. Okay.
So just a minute, bear with me a few minutes.
And then, what is the Mishnah principle? The distribution of the estate between the woman and the creditor should be a CG consistent one, so that we can apply this principle of the Talmud or Shittat Shnei Hachashim. So find a distribution that is consistent with Shittat Shnei Hachashim. That's probably the intention of the Mishnah.
First question, maybe this is the one you wanted to ask.
First question, do we have such a distribution always? Maybe if you have 13 creditors and the claims are 100, 250, etc., the state is, let's say, 500, there is not that distribution that is consistent with the principle of Shnei Mahadim. Here is where the answer of James comes.
And it can be proved mathematically, the following fantastic theorem.
Given any number of creditors, can be 3 women, or 17, or 1 million creditors, given any amount of claims, can be 100, 200, 300, 250, 125, 17, whatever it is, and given any amount of the estate to be distributed, there is always a CG consistent distribution of the estate between the creditors. Always you can find a distribution that will fulfill the Talmudic principle of Shnei Mohammed. That can be proved mathematically, so it's true. Mathematically, you can find such distribution. That's all I'm saying. You can find, there is such in always, in any case.
Agreement
about what?
No, not yet.
Each one has a different
claim. I have to agree that he is supposed to get $50. Otherwise,
if you are claiming only 100 and the stake is 500, so you don't have any claim on the other 400. I mean, we don't have to ask you, we are saying that you are.
What's the concept that makes this fair? I mean, it's sounding right mathematically.
Maybe it's not fair, we can discuss it, but this is what the Mishnah says, okay? Okay, maybe it's not what we see, that it's fair, but for the time being, I'm not.
What is making this mathematics?
I will say, but for the time being, I want to say that I'm not trying to make the Mishnah fair or not. I'm trying to understand it and to explain it. You can say the Mishnah is not fair. Okay, we'll talk about it. But at least we want us to agree that this is an interpretation of the Mishnah. We didn't finish yet.
What would be the question of that theorem? Is that theorem obvious?
Obvious?
Theorem?
No, it's not obvious.
Mathematically, you have to think of a situation that given any number of creditors, where it would not work out, that we're going to divide it, which is doubtful, and that we agree upon what we want to get.
It's very, very complicated. It can be the case that if you have 2,000 creditors, and the first one is asking, let's say, for $2, second one for $200, and the last one for $1,000, and the estate is 745, you cannot find the distribution of the estate in the creditors, such that every pair of creditors will be satisfied by the way that the total amount given to them is distributed. It may be the case. So it can be proved that there is always such a distribution.
Okay, now the next question, just a minute, Pacienza, my friend, just wait and you will see.
Now, another question can be, okay, you prove that there is always a distribution. Maybe in some cases there can be 2 different distributions, maybe 3, maybe 4 different distributions. How is the Beit Din going to decide which distribution to adopt? Because there are several ways of having this distribution which is CG consistent. So here comes the second theorem, and it says for any given set of parameters as before, there is always a unique distribution that satisfies the Shittah Shnei Mohammed. Unique. There is always one and only one. So you don't have the problem of which one do I choose. There is exactly one distribution. And the Mishnah is telling you, for every case, try and find the only distribution that makes Shittah Shnei Mohammed valid. Now the idea is of Hashemah that if we...
Once you say there's only one, it sounds already we're approaching equity. If that's the only way that it could be.
Not because of equity, but if I am Dayan, I have to follow the Talmudic principle. Talmudic principle says, Shittah Shnei Mohammed. If I have a different distribution, and you
Dayan can only follow Shittah Shnei Mohammed, in this case, it's logical to be fair. In the other cases, we know it's fair. Each case, you look at it, you see it's fair. This one, it has to be fair to the Dayan.
But then,
and it looks like it. There's only one possible
that
already approaches a little bit.
Because if the Dayan decides to give another distribution, different number, then according to this theorem, I can find a pair of creditors who can come to Beit Din and tell Beit Din, look, you allocated to both of us 125, but you didn't distribute it according to Shnei Mohammed. I asked you to distribute it, and that would be right.
But ask the Dayanim to distribute it for the Shnei Mohammed. That's subjective at first, until you find an objective reason.
But no, it's not subjective. It's a principle of Talmud. It's halakha.
No. There's no such thing as principle of Talmud and halakha if it's not fair. It's only when it's fair that it becomes
fair. You agree that it's fair. I mean,
it's fair only for one reason now, because you tell me it's unique and there's no expected.
Okay.
No, it's very important that a Dayan can't just say because in Bamis Yahweh, we have more, we said that was fair. Over there, they weren't fair. It's obvious that Shnei Mohammed, that the fair way is, which Rich is very important, because they say he's more dear to the other one here,
yes.
they're poking on here,
yes.
and when two people
are... And this is exactly what you are asking for every pair of creditors, every pair.
Every pair, but yeah. The pair will say, why should I be subject to this consistency of Shinai Mor Hazin distribution, just because you want to make everybody else consistent with that? But if there's only one unique system,
right. Okay. So there's one.
You must get that to your shiur.
I think that even without this is confirmed. But anyway, if you agree, we don't argue about that.
No, I'm just saying.
Yes.
I'm saying you have to hear that it has to be fair. Maybe society-wise, it's fair.
That's
the only way
you
could be fair to everyone.
I'm saying this is not the halacha, right? So there are
No, but I'm saying as far as what Rabbi Natan means, we have to interpret Rabbi Natan that it's fair to the dayan, to Rabbi Natan. Without that additional sentence, it doesn't come out mathematically.
We'll see that there are four different approaches to distribute, and this one is one of them, and all of them might seem fair to another point of view.
Yeah,
okay, so for the time being then, we are left with this interpretation of the Mishnah. What the Binatan is saying, you have to look for every case for the unique distribution that is consistent with the Shittat Shai Mohammed. And you get three examples which fit, and that's it. And for all other cases, you have to find the distribution for yourself. No, here is another question, big question. Now I am Beijing, and I
am
Beijing. We'll come to that. Very good question, and remind me if I forget, but it's very important. Tablanut, right, paciencia. Now, very good, we understand the Mishnah, and you are now Beijing. Or you are a Beijing, and you have a case coming with bankruptcy, with five creditors, with different amounts. So let us look for the unique distribution that satisfies the Shittat Shai Mohammed. You go home and you try different numbers, and that's what there are millions of possibilities of this. So how can I find this distribution? If it's just a theoretical principle, I have to find it to give the decision, the ruling of the court. So is there an algorithm, a method, a systematic method to find this distribution? Otherwise it's worthless. There is. And I'll show you now two different approaches for a systematic method of finding this distribution. One of them is, I would call it physical algorithm, the other one a numerical one. Let's begin with the physical algorithm, and this was the contribution of the Polish mathematicians that I mentioned before. Look at this picture, and we are going to describe an algorithm for finding the unique CG consistent solution, and we are going to base it on the principle of interconnected vessels. Now this is the law of physics that again everybody learned in high school or maybe in elementary school. It's called Pascal's law. It was discovered in the 16th century, 17th century by Pascal, and it says the following: if you have a set of vessels connected, whatever shape, this one can be round, this one doesn't matter, and you pour some more liquid in the system, then ultimately after a few seconds the liquid will be at the same level in all the vessels. No matter one is big, one is short, one is thin, doesn't matter, liquid will be exactly at the same level in all of the vessels. And this is because of the atmospheric pressure. So this is one now law of physics, as I said, everybody learned it. Now the algorithm, the system is as follows. Build such a set of interconnected vessels in the following way. Give a vessel to each creditor. In the case of the Mishnah, we have three creditors, so we have three vessels connected. Each vessel consists of two parts, a bottom part and an upper part. Both of them are equal in volume. You can see it here, you can see it there, you can see it. Third question, so a vessel to each creditor, all vessels have the same height and the same radius. So all of the vessels finish at the same height and they have the same radius. And each vessel is composed of two equal parts, as here, and the volume of each vessel equals that creditor's claim. So if this is the vessel for Sarah, the volume of the two parts is 100 units of something, of centimeters, whatever it is, because it is the claim of Sarah. The volume in this case of both, of the bottom part and the upper part together is 200, and the volume of the third vessel is 300. So each vessel, the volume of each vessel of the two parts together is exactly the claim of the Ketubah of the woman. And you assume also that the volume of the connecting two tubes, this tube, connecting tube, and this one, are very, very thin, so they don't really take any, it's negligible, let's say it's zero. So, okay, so we said that the tubes are very thin, so it's only zero liquid that is there. So you build such an equipment for every case. And then what is the algorithm? You pour into the system a liquid, let's say water, equal in volume to the acid. If the acid is 100, you pour into the system 100 centiliters. If it's 200, you pour 200. If it's 300, you pour 300. If it's 350, you pour whatever it is, you pour in the system exactly this amount of water. And then you see what is the level of each one of this vessel. And you give to each creditor the amount of dollars equal to the volume of the to the level of this of his vessel with water.
That's okay, one step to explain the
three
vessels.
Okay, the
three
vessels. Okay, for every creditor you have one vessel. Okay, so you have 17 creditors, you have to have 17 vessels. All of the vessels have the same radius, and all of them finish at the same line, at the same height.
Why is
it important? Each one of them is composed of two parts, of equal volume. And then the final condition is that the volume of the vessel is proportional or equal to the claim of the creditor. If it's claiming 300, you have this vessel with whose volume is 300 or 200 or 100. That's the setting, that's the system. Now, when you have a claim with, let's say, 200 assets, you pour 200 units into the system and you see each vessel where is what is the level of the water, and you give the water or the dollar to the creditor. Now, this sounds very, very remote from the Shitat Shanayim Mahazin. Again, it can be proved mathematically, rigorously, that you get exactly the Shitat Shanayim Mahazin. The sense that when you look at the distribution and you check for every pair of creditors, you will see that this pair gets an amount which is distributed among them according to Shitat Shanayim Mahazin. Now I can show you maybe one or two cases how this thing works. One or two cases of different assets. And
is it the same thing that they approved that the top part of the bottom part of the one, and theoretically it's just that this is one and one vessel, right?
Yes, the actual height of this vessel of this tube is not important.
So when
the water is pouring in, that's very similar, including the connecting tube. So let us take for example the first case, by the way, this transparency was prepared for me by Moshe Arfin, so I'd like to thank him for that. Let's take the first case in which the assets were 100. And you remember Sarah is asking for 100, Rivka 200, and Sarah 300. So this one is 50 and 50, 100 and 100, 150, 100. Now if I pour 100 into this system, 100 will not, and you can see that the level of the water will not even cover the 50, because it has to be the same level in the three vessels. So it will be, in fact, it cannot go over in this connecting tube, because if it goes over, then it has 50 already here, and if that 50 here, 50 here, it will be 150, but you have only 100. So it's obvious that in this case, the water level will come to a little bit less than the 50, so it will be 33 and 33. And if you take the case of the 200, and you look at the diagram, and you analyze it, you will find that this is exactly what the Mishnah said. 50, look at this, 50, and this one is 0. And you agree that this is very small, so it's negligible, it's 0. This one is 75, and this one is 75, and all of them are the same level. So 50, 75, 75. This is the case that it all cannot be extended. This is the explanation. This is the way it gets it. And you can check it for 300 and for 400. You will get exactly the number of the Mishnah for 300, and you will get the numbers for 300, or whatever. You can have 1,000 creditors, you can have any number of claims, any amount of claims, any amount of assets. It will always work like that.
So we draw an algorithm for this. Let me just stop for a moment and say, what about the Minatel? How come the Minatel thought about that? Yeah. What is that?
Okay, so did you know the other games? I don't know. Let me just tell you the story of how Robert Oman found this solution. Robert Oman attacked this Mishnah. First of all, he said, let me forget about everything, and let us see it as a game market. We have resources. This is asset. Let's say we have $100. And you have some creditors or some people that are asking for these resources, and there is not enough for everyone to get what he's paying for. So how do we distribute? It's a kind of game, and analyzing it by game theory, he found out that what is called in game theory, the nucleus of the game, something I don't have to understand, is exactly what Mishnah says. 33 and 30, 33 and 30, in the first case, 50, 75, 75. By the way, this nucleus idea was given by Nash when he was working in the mental hospital. And there is a very, very complex theorem, very complex principles that go into this thing. So Omar said, well, that fits fantastically. But then he said, come on, it can't be that Jonathan knew about serious games and about the nucleolus. Well, of course, there are some people that think, yes, our Hazal knew everything that has been known, not only at the time, but they know all of the things that will ever be discovered, so they know about the relativity, and they knew, Tanaim knew about quantum theory, about the end. Okay, so if they knew about everything, I don't argue with them. But I don't think so. This is nonsense. Of course, this is nonsense. Of course, it's nonsense. Hachamim says the Gemara. Im amru lecha chokhmah yesh ba'amim, Tanaim. Because we are not working on Chokhmah, we are working on Torah. We want to find a way to fulfill the mitzvot of Hashem and to find the right way to live. And no, we're not thinking about that. If the elite science is accepted. Okay. So how will we answer? So he looked at it again and he found this interesting Mishnah of Shnayim Mochazim. And he found out that this Shnayim Mochazim can explain maybe how Rabbi Natan came to this number. Because Rabbi Natan says, look, if I'm going to distribute it in any way, I want to make sure that for any pair, they don't come back to me and say, hey, this is wrong because we are getting this amount and it is distributed between us, not according to Shnayim Mochazim. So he had this idea that the distribution has to be consistent to Shnayim Mochazim. And he tried a few numbers and the schedules and it came out fine. So he wrote this Mishnah. Did he know that there is always one distribution, a new distribution? Probably had this intuition, but he didn't prove it mathematically. But this is the way he thought it should be handled. Not because of his own idea. Because this is Talmudic principle of Shnayim Mochazim. And if you choose any other distribution, any other, including the proportional one, which is the one he used now, you will find out that there is some pair of creditors that can come back and claim, look, the agreement is distributed between us according to this principle. And you agreed beforehand that this principle is not only Talmudic principle, but it's also logical. So this way, he found the solution using game theory. But once you find it, you don't really need game theory, because you can check the distribution whether or not it is according to Shnayim Mochazim, according to this Talmudic principle. So this is about your question, did Rabbi Natan know game theory? He didn't know. But he knew Shnayim Mochazim, and he wanted to find a solution that fit with the halakha of Shnayim Mochazim.
Can he found it? Theory is equal to
Shnayim Mochazim?
Yes.
Are
we extrapolating from
Shnayim
Mochazim game theory?
No.
Shnayim
Mochazim
is an example
of
game theory.
Right. No. Shnayim Mochazim is not an example. The principle that if you have distributions that satisfy this and this, then there is always such a distribution, and the distribution is unique, is from game theory. Okay.
What is
game theory?
Well, I said it in the beginning of my talk. This is a branch of mathematics.
No.
The idea about games. Not games for children, but games like war games or like a market game. When you have to split resources between different people and there is not enough for each. So how do you play in order to win? Or if you are in a war, you have 500 tanks and 200 airplanes, and the enemy has 500 tanks and 25 airplanes. And you know that if you attack this way or that, so you are in there. And you want to find the strategy that you should always win. So this is the answer.
But it's a mathematical method. No, yes.
The modern war, for every three characters, and every four characters, have 100. I take two as the only one. I take three, I take four. The always one for endless possible combination.
Well, that's a good question.
The first question, second question, yes. You have put in that gap, so the Mishnah has talked about more than 300. But putting the 350% gap, you have to get the model of the Mishnah, but not necessarily the intent of the Mishnah.
Why?
Because the Mishnah never said, unless you said the Mishnah spoke about the limits, you make Talmudic. But there is a question that will be answered. I think there's some debate. I'm not
okay.
So I'm not thinking on it. But the fact that you kept at 50, and then you said after 50, because one was the most has to get more, you introduced something there that should not explain.
Okay. For the first question. For the first question. The principle of Rai Mohadin can be really applied only for two. Yeah, but maybe you can find the principle for three or four. The answer is not really. Why? Because when you have two, either they agree both of them on something or they don't agree. When you have three or four or five, you may find that this one agrees with this one or this one, that this one agrees with this two or this one. So you can't really find. So the principle of Mishnah Hadim is just for two. And what the Mishnah says is that you should check that the distribution among 17 creditors should be in such a way that for every two, the principle applies. So this is for the first question. For the second question, I think nobody really knows what the Mishnah had in mind. We know the numbers. And you are trying to find a logical way that fits the numbers. And this kind of idea fits the numbers and fits it beautifully. And the Gemara understanding of the Mishnah does not fit the numbers because they had the Kushya, which was not really answered. So we find a way which is very not only very logical but also according to Talmudic principles to explain the numbers of the Mishnah. So we can assume that maybe Meratan had this in mind because he said this number. But we don't really know what he had in mind, but we can assume that this is because we found an interpretation, a very different interpretation, according to which it fits with other Talmudic halachot. So what's better than that? He didn't say you have to cut it here or there, but I found it. And I'll do it, whatever it is, that gives this number. I'm content with that. Okay. Now, as I said, we can find also a numerical algorithm for finding this number. And since time is now getting too short, this is a very interesting way of computing the distribution, and I'm going over it quite rapidly, but this is way to do it. That is in two steps. The first step, the principle is dividing the estate equally between all creditors as long as no creditor gets more than half his claim. So, no creditor is getting more than half his claim until all creditors get half theirs. This is the principle. You have to distribute in such a way that you distribute it equally until you see that someone is getting half of his claim. When he's getting half of his claim, you tell him, okay, you are out of the game, and you continue with the others until one more creditor gets half of his claim. You are out of the game and you continue until, if there is enough asset, everyone gets half of his claim. So nobody is getting more than half his claim until everybody are getting half of the claim. Now suppose everybody gets half of the claim and there is still some asset. What do you do with it? Now this is a symmetrical or a mirror type distribution. Step D, the principle is dividing the estate in such a way that ultimately all losses are equal. Not the quantity of money that is reaching everyone is equal, but the quantity of money that everyone is losing is equal. So suppose someone is losing $100,000 because his loan was immediate, and the other guy is losing $50 only. So the one who is losing $100,000 can tell the other, why should you lose only 50 and I should lose $100,000? My dollar is worth like the dollar. If I'm losing for 50, I would like also lose only 50. What do you care if I have more? Because your dollar is as worth as mine. So the second step, if there is more than half of the claim for everybody, you divide the state in such a way that the losses as much as possible will be equal between all the creditors. Now, this has to be, of course, translated into specific steps, how to compute. And these are the specific steps. I'm not going to wait. We don't have time. But believe me, it gives exactly the CG consistent distribution. So the idea, when you read about the half, there is something in it. This is really part of the algorithm. Why? It works. This is not this way. And it fits the number of the Mishnah, and it's the only distribution, as we saw. There is one distribution. So any way you can get it, it's a good way, because there is only one type distribution. if you get it by this algorithm and other algorithm, we have to prove that it always gives us the correct distribution. That's it. We are satisfied.
I can just add on there. I think that the principle we can see is dealing with human nature. If Hashem is worried about if it's fair or not. The principle is assuming human nature, if he got what he wanted, he'll be happy. And that's al-hanu'a of Mexico. Maybe you'll find somebody that has hard in the heart. They know if he's getting a little more, even though I asked for half, oh, now I'm not happy. Could be that people like that. And I think the principle assumes that most people are happy with what they ask for, and that's why it's fair, because that's what most people want. You have one guy that's mignon, but not that close. That's what I tell. We don't.
Okay.
Most of what you just said, I agree with you. It's finding a system that maximizes what the broken Adam, an average person, would be satisfied with, and then you come up with what should be fair to the world, which is a fantastic one. Yeah, but everybody has to be
fair. Okay, just if you allow me, I would like to finish before going into discussion with one final transparency, because you don't have to do more than that. And in this transparency, I'll show you that there are four different ways, totally different ways, of doing this distribution of estate between creditors in a bankruptcy case. The first system is just the CG consistent approach, which we just saw, and this is himself with Benatan. Now, the question is, someone asked me, why is Benatan is Holek on this? Why is Bill Holek on Benatan?
Well,
the answer can be very simple. As I said, Benatan was one generation before Bill. So, and what Benatan said was always Alaha, because he's Dayana, he's not Kadishina. So, Benatan said this, and this was the halakha which was more or less prevalent in Israel. So Rabbi put it in the Mishnah, it's not Mishnah, this is halakha. But then the logic of Rabbi Natan was wrong. Nobody remembered why was this number. So not only was not on Rabbi, but was probably on all of his generation, because if someone was knew what it is, he would tell Rabbi. So Rabbi is seeing the Mishnah, halakha which is prevalent. But makes no sense. Why should this someone get 50? Why not? So he said, and anyway, I don't understand what is. So, since I don't understand it, Chokol Beshave, that's why he disagreed with Rabbi Natan already, because he didn't understand his logic. Something was missing for him, and he said, I can't really see what he's talking about. So I'm saying, Chokol Beshave. That's probably one expression of what happened. And that's why Rabbi didn't put it in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah was the halakha at his time. This is what Beijing would be doing. But nobody understood why it was doing, and nobody knew how to do it in other cases. So he said, we can't go on like that. So he said, in the Baraita, look, Rabbi Natan said what he said, I don't know why he said it, so from now on, this will be the Alcha, or condition. Now, so the first method then is a CG consistent approach. A second method, which is extremely interesting and complex, but I don't have time to go into it, is Shita Tarif and Rashi, the way they extend the Mishnah. And this is the lead approach, and it gives totally different number. Okay? And the principle of this approach is the following. Every creditor has a lien on the estate for the exact amount of his claim. That's one principle. Second principle, every zuz, every dollar, should be distributed equally between all creditors that have a lien on this dollar. So in fact, we are now looking at this case, not from the point of view of the creditors, I claim 100, we look at the estate. And you look at every dollar of the estate, who has a lien on this dollar? You and you and you. We divide it equally because the lien is the same for all of them. And we go dollar per dollar, so to speak, and see what is the lien, who has a lien on this dollar, and distribute them, we distribute the dollar between them equally. This is Shittat Rashi and Arif, and this is according to them the way the Gemara understood the Mishnah. So the Gemara understanding of the Mishnah according to Rashi. But however, this understanding is not good for the Mishnah. It's very interesting, and it can be another fair way of distributing the assets, but this is not a good interpretation of the Mishnah, because according to this interpretation, the numbers don't fit. You look at the numbers here, you look at the numbers, you see different numbers.
But this is another way.
Hadith is explaining
the deed. Hadith
is explaining
the deed. No. Hadith tells what I said, the sugya of the Gemara, how the Gemara interpreted the Mishnah. And this is what Rashi also explains. That's first. Okay? So they had this shita of Shehabudim. They said this is the way the Gemara understood the Mishnah is working. And this is what the Gemara made this Mishnah, and this is what that is. According to Rabbi now, so, okay, anyway, you have now two different approaches. According to Rabbi now, as I said, Rabbi is the halakha. And Rabbi's decision can be interpreted in two different ways. Rabbi's opinion, according to Rif, Rambam, Tu, and Shulchan Aruch, is equal part approach. Divide the state equally between all creditors, as long as no creditor gets more than his debt. How to do it? Rabbi explains it very carefully, and he gives a lot of numerical examples in the Mishneh Torah, how to apply Rabbi opinions according to his interpretation between all the creditors. So basically, you divide it equally, but you take care that not to give any creditor more than what he is paying. So this is halakha according to Rif, Rambam, to Shulchan Aruch. Now, Rabbeinu Hananel, and following him the Tosafot, and following him Ramban and the Yitzvah, interpret Rabbi's opinion in different ways. They say Rabbi had in mind to do a proportional approach. That's all. So the halakha should be, you should split the estate in a proportional approach. And this is how, as I said, Rabbeinu Hananel, and Tosafot, and Rambam and Yitzvah say, divide the estate in order proportionally to their two. Which is what is now commonly done. But no one thought of doing maybe the first way, the strictly consistent way, or maybe the Rif approach, which are very interesting and are as fair as any other approach. But somehow, nobody thought about it and nobody is applying it. And what Oman said is, instead, why not try this kind of new type of division? And as I said, there were a lot of responses and etc. about it. So this is then the interpretation of the Mishnah.
What's he recommending, Professor Oman, what do you recommend as advantage of this system of the proportional way?
He doesn't, he says this is very interesting. First of all, he says this is the doesn't recommend. So this is the interpretation of the Mishnah. First of all, we have now a new, brilliant, very useful interpretation of the Mishnah. And you have one way, two ways, think about it. No. He only suggests this is as fair as any other one. He doesn't say more or less. Okay, I'd like to end my talk by just quoting one thing. Pasuk says, Kol po'al Hashem emanu. Everything God created is for His name. Kol hanivra lishmi, lekvudi, lerasi, lefasi, lefasiti. So maybe, someone told me, maybe the study of games was invented just to give an expression for Binatan, so that you can see that Binatan was really a deep dayan. Well, there are other applications, but the most important one is that you know how a good interpretation of Binatan. And this shows you how studying scientific fields can help us understand Torah. Binatan, what he said in Mishnah, nobody has studied it till today. No Geonim, no Reshonim, no Haronim. Nobody gets any kind of interpretation that can put the number of Binatan in a logical way. And this is now, we have it. We have it because of game theory. And without it, we couldn't have even thought about this kind of... So thank you very much for your attention. And
I think we have time for two questions.